Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
This audio presentation contains graphic details of death, violence, and controversial subject matter. Listener discretion is strongly advised. From Dead Souls Media, this is What Happened to Johnny? I'm Jamie Black, a researcher and psychologist, and I'll be your host for tonight. This episode is part one of a two-part series. And in tonight's episode, we talk about a missing person, a 40-year-old mystery, and a possible conspiracy and cover-up that allegedly goes right up to the White House. No cap, this is a big one.
That's Jenny. But that's not Jenny's dad. If she gets into that car, you may be looking at Jenny for the last time. I'm McGruff, the crime dog. Let me show you something. See that playground? A lot of kids there. Every day in this country, 60 kids disappear. Some run away, but a lot are kidnapped by strangers or even by people they know. Almost 20,000 kids a year. 20,000 kids. One kid at a time. Maybe your kid. On your street. Just like Jenny. You know, your kids can learn to protect themselves against crime at home, at school, on the street. Hey, nice going, Jenny. She's gonna tell her folks about this. And you can write to McGruff. Learn how to keep your family and your community safe and help take a bite out of crime.
A few months ago, we produced an episode titled Missing, The Disappearance of Lee Boxall. We detailed the strange events that surrounded a London teenager that vanished seemingly into thin air in September of 1988, and the tragic yet somewhat mysterious details about that case. At the time of its release, we explained that it would be part of a series of missing persons episodes. Initially, we promised two. This will now be three, after we were asked to research and cover another case in the same manner by one of our listeners, named Carol. Carol is from Newton, a city in Iowa in the United States. It's famous for its speedway and botanical gardens, I'm told. And Carol makes it sound absolutely lovely, so I'm definitely going to have to take a trip there someday. This is Carol's email to us, which she has very kindly agreed for us to release to you guys.
Hey guys, I have just caught up on a bunch of your episodes. I missed a few when I was working out of state, so it was really good to get home and have four episodes to binge on in one evening. Your research and attention to detail without creating fake drama is fantastic, and I honestly think you guys are one of the best shows out there that do what you do. Among the recent episodes that I binged on, one stood out to me. It was the episode about the kid who went missing in the UK back in the 80s. Lee Boxall? But you also talked about the investigation that happened afterwards. It was so interesting, but it also had a real creepy vibe to it. The fact there are obviously people out there that knew what happened to him, and maybe even people listening to the show that have more info but aren't telling, seriously sends shivers down my spine. There's a very similar story to this one that happened years ago in the place I grew up. I'm from Newton in Iowa now. I have lived all over, but I moved here with my husband after I got married, and we have three teenage boys. I've been here about 25 years, but I was born and raised in Des Moines, a city about 30 miles away. It's a pretty big city, and I'm guessing you've heard of it. You guys seem worldly wise. I was born in the 72 and lived on Walnut Street in Des Moines with my parents and older brother. When I was about 10 years old, a young boy from near where I lived went missing. It made national news and became a huge deal. His name was Johnny Gosch, and he was never found. Have you heard about this case? The disappearance itself is really, really mysterious, but it's everything that happened afterwards is where it gets crazy. If you have the time, take a look at the Wikipedia link below and tell me what you think. I would love you to research and make an episode about this story. It certainly needs someone to separate all the facts from the fiction, to take away all the lies that are out there about it. Everything I have seen about this story is either biased or unreliable, so I would do anything to see some proper time and work go into uncovering what actually happened to that poor boy. Having teenage sons of my own, and with it happening just a few miles away from me when I was young, really touches a nerve with me. It's haunting, and I can't imagine how that family managed to stay so strong and get through the nightmare they did. The mother of Johnny Gosh, Noreen, is an absolute hero to me. She is so strong. Anyway, thanks you guys. Write back if you need any further info about this one, or if you need anyone to head out to the locations to take pictures or whatever, just let me know. I'll be happy to help. All my love, Carol.
So firstly, a huge thank you to Carol for reaching out and for the fantastic voice work. We loved getting this message, and this episode is for you, Carol. Because as it happens, we were already familiar with the case of Johnny Gosh, and both Grace on my team and I had been researching it quietly for more than a year or so. So Carol, your email was perfect timing. It's also super helpful to have someone in the area and familiar with the location to help us out with this one. So as promised to Carol and to share with all of you guys, we have taken a deep look into this case and gone back to the original police records, the original media reports, and official data and documents from the time, which I think is the only way to get accurate information on this specific case. And you will hear why shortly. We've also spoken to a number of individuals who knew Johnny personally. We've spoken to eyewitnesses who were there on the morning that Johnny went missing, and who also lived and still live in the neighborhood where this tragic and mysterious incident took place. Our aim with this episode is to share all of the facts and present an unbiased and balanced record of the case data. Our aim is not to solve this case. Our aim is not to prove or disprove any theories of this case. We are not looking to push an outcome that we think is what happened. We will allow you guys to judge for yourselves and put together your own thoughts, because our aim is just to share all the facts and information. I want to make this absolutely clear from the start, as this case and subject matter has proven to be somewhat controversial over the years. And the various theories as to what happened to Johnny have both fervent supporters and vehement opponents within the online community. We are not looking to take sides nor cause any further controversy, which is why we won't be speculating. Where information is circumstantial or questionable in its source, we will say so. We will also include details of all our factual sources at the end of this episode. So with all that said, what happened to Johnny Gosh?
For the third straight day, volunteers turned out to look for clues to the boy's disappearance.
It's just gripping every single minute of the day, worrying about his safety, whether he's warm, whether he's had food. All of these things that when days go by, you just wonder if he's even going to come back.
The female voice you hear in that clip is Noreen Gosh, Johnny's mother. According to my podcast stats, the majority of my listeners are between the ages of 24 to 40 years of age. You guys are primarily based in the UK, United States, Canada, and Australia. This means that you will almost certainly remember the core memory I'm about to unlock. Paper routes. Did you have one as a kid or teenager? They fell by the wayside in the mid-2000s once newspaper sales fell off with the growing popularity of online news. But back in the 1990s and prior, a paper route was a rite of passage for many children growing up in the age before the internet. It was a way to learn responsibility and make some pocket money in neighborhoods across America, Britain, Australia, Canada, and many other European countries. It was common to see kids on bicycles or walking in the early morning hours, tossing newspapers onto porches before school. It was considered safe, even routine. But I'm getting ahead of myself here. Let's talk about the victim. John David Gosch, known to family and friends affectionately as Johnny, was born on November 12, 1969, to Noreen and John Gosch Sr. in Des Moines, Iowa. John Gosch Sr. was an Army veteran and a businessman in the farm chemical industry. Noreen was a yoga instructor and homemaker. Johnny wasn't Noreen's first child. She had two children from her previous marriage, Joe and Christy. Noreen had married her first husband young. They had two children, but her husband soon became sick with cancer. During her husband's sickness, the family's home was hit by a huge tornado that destroyed everything that Noreen and her family owned. Noreen has since stated that all she can remember from that time is searching for her children in the rubble and aftermath of the tornado. Her only focus was to find her children. She was a mother more than anything else, she said. Eventually, she did find her children, and luckily they were not seriously hurt. But it lit a fire in Noreen, and she said she became more focused and tenacious because of it. 2 months after the tornado had taken her home and possessions, her husband sadly passed away, but Noreen held things together somehow. She was left to raise her children alone, and without a home or any belongings, yet her struggles were far from over. Noreen met John Gosch Sr. a few years later after some friends of hers said that she had to get out there and meet new people. Noreen was reluctant at first, given all she had been through, but eventually she realized that she needed to move forward and not dwell on the past. John Gosch Sr. had met Noreen through a friend that he had been in the Marine Corps with, and the two hit it off from the get-go. They married shortly after, and early on in their marriage, Noreen gave birth to John Gosch Jr., Johnny. The family lived in an affluent, middle-class area of West Des Moines at 1004 45th Street. Don't worry, I'm not doxing them. The family moved from this address many years ago. Although, I will add, please do not visit this location. The current owners do not appreciate those with a morbid curiosity, shall we say, and they will absolutely not engage with those interested in the Johnny Gosch case. I cannot stress this enough. The streets back then were safe, respectable, and altogether serene. They still are to the most part to this day. For all intents and purposes, it was your typical, well-to-do, American, middle-class, suburban neighborhood. Des Moines is the most populous city in the state of Iowa. It was founded in 1843 as a hub for transportation and commerce. As the 20th century progressed, it would grow to become an insurance and finance center, not just for the state, but for the country as a whole. As with most major cities, since the highs of the 1950s, the populations were dipping, with families moving outwards into ever-growing suburban sprawls. One such suburb was that of West Des Moines. Technically, it was a city on its own, although West Des Moines has embraced being a part of Des Moines as a whole, doing so when they changed from their original name of Valley Junction in 1938. But by the 1980s, West Des Moines was the largest suburb in the city and one of the most developed, with nearby suburbs of Urbandale and Clive having been incorporated much more recently. Even so, its population was only 22,000 residents in 1980, or 11.5% of the Des Moines' total residency. While the new I-235 highway had brought bigger businesses along that corridor, most of the city was characterized by its quiet residential developments. It was suburbia personified. Families were drawn to its well-regarded school system, low crime rates, and sense of community. At the end of one such street altogether indistinguishable from any number of others, was a ranch-style house similar to a number of other homes in the area. It was home to a stereotypical all-American family. The Goshes would move into this house on 45th Street shortly after its construction in 1975. And indeed, Johnny was your typical all-American kid. He loved playing outdoors with friends, playing drums, go-kart racing, and building snow forts in the winter. He was a Boy Scout who loved the outdoors, and he was passionate about baseball and dirt bikes. Dirt bikes were a particular interest for Johnny. He often spent time with his older stepbrother Joe, riding bikes off-road in the hills around West Des Moines. In fact, Johnny had his sights set on a brand new yellow Yamaha dirt bike for himself, and he took a job as a paperboy so he could save up money for the bike. Johnny's dad has said that his son was very thoughtful and often took the time to pick out the perfect gift for people on special occasions. He was a sensitive kid. He spent a lot of time and thought ensuring that the gift that he gave those that he cared about would be loved and appreciated. He cared deeply about the feelings of others and did all he could to ensure that those he cared about were happy. In fact, he often returned home with a flower for his mother that he had purchased to remind her how much he cared for her. He was very well mannered. He had a slight stutter when he was upset, his parents said. But Johnny was also potentially a little overly cared for by his mother in particular, shall we say. Noreen was extremely caring and somewhat overbearing towards Johnny. He was the youngest of her three children, but can you blame her given what she had gone through up until this point? It wasn't long before Johnny had saved up the money he needed for the new dirt bike, which he coveted so much. But even after purchasing the bike, Johnny continued with his paper route. He was really good at his job, one of the best that the Des Moines Register, the paper he delivered, had on their teenage payroll. Johnny even won sales and positive customer service awards. This earned him a flight in a private airplane as a prize. He loved being a paperboy. It was quite the badge of honor around middle and high school kids in the area at the time. Johnny would take his little red wagon and his little dog Gretchen, a black and toffee brown dachshund, along with him in the morning. He enjoyed delivering along his route. Almost always, his dad would also accompany him, because Johnny was only 12 years old after all. In fact, John Gosch Sr. stated that he accompanied Johnny on every single paper delivery journey that he did, with the exception of one, his last. The disappearance. On Sunday, September the 5th, 1982, the day before Labor Day, John Gosch Sr. started receiving phone calls to the family's West Des Moines home from around 7:30 a.m. from annoyed neighbors. They were inquiring as to the whereabouts of their morning newspaper, saying that they were concerned because Johnny hadn't delivered them yet. In September 2022, Noreen Gosch gave an interview with the Des Moines Register, something which you will find later is both shocking and ironic. But I'm going to play the interview here, as Noreen does a great job of explaining what happened on that day in September 1982.
Before September 5th, 1982, I was a homemaker, housewife, mother. I lived what I've considered to be a normal, happy life, doing things with my kids, going to ball games, baking cookies, doing all the mom things. And then on September 5th, my entire world blew apart when someone kidnapped my son, Johnny, while he was delivering his Sunday morning papers in West Des Moines, Iowa. That morning started out very early for him, like any other day. He left the house at about 5:45 in the morning. He headed down the street pulling his little wagon and our dog riding along with him. He got as far as the corner about a block from our home, when a man stopped him and asked for directions. Johnny was always instructed not to talk to strangers, so he didn't go over to the car and spend time. The other kids at the corner, who were the witnesses, were the ones that reported all of this to me. As Johnny walked away from this man, the man suddenly made a U-turn in the middle of the street with his car and sped back up the street and pulled in right where all the boys were gathering their papers, folding them, and preparing to deliver their own routes. The man shut off the engine to the car, opened the passenger door, and slid his feet out onto the curb and started talking to all the boys. He spoke with a very slurred speech pattern, according to what I was told by the witnesses. Johnny turned to one of the witnesses, Mike, who was 16, and he said, "This man is nuts. There's something wrong with him. I'm scared and I'm leaving." Johnny threw all his papers into the wagon and took off down the street. The other boys that were at the corner at that time also left. There was a 44-year-old attorney that had pulled up with his car to grab his son's papers. And he had paid attention to the man and the license plate, but didn't know that a crime was about to occur. And he left. Johnny, as he was walking down the street, was just minding his own business when Mike heard our little dog growl. At that very moment, the man who had driven up in the car suddenly pulled himself back in the car, slammed the door, started the engine, and then reached up with his hand and clicked the dome light 3 times. At that very moment, Mike looked down the street after Johnny, saw Johnny walking along, and then saw another man come out between 2 houses and follow my son. The man was about 6'3" and stayed about a half a block behind Johnny. I doubt very much that my son even knew he was being followed. He then went around the corner, out of the direct eyesight of Mike. A few seconds later, Mike heard a car door slam, the screeching of tires, and he saw that very same car that had been at the corner where he was sitting earlier run the stop sign, turn left, which was north, and head straight towards the interstate, which is out of town. This all took place in approximately 12 minutes from the time my son left home.
It seems kind of funny looking back now. People angrily calling up the home of the paper boy as the newspaper was late. I guess times were different and more innocent back then. Or maybe not so innocent, actually. Because in fairness, the neighbours were yet to find out the reason why their papers had not been delivered that morning. The newspapers, being late, were very unlike Johnny. He was always so punctual and reliable. The following information regarding what happened next is taken from Noreen Gosh's self-published book titled Why Johnny Can't Come Home. Quote, John got in his car and drove down the street looking for Johnny. He thought maybe he had fallen behind and needed a hand. John Sr. arrived at a nearby corner, 42nd Street and Marcourt Lane, where he came across Johnny's red newspaper wagon, abandoned. It read Gosh on the side of it, and it was still full of newspapers. Gretchen, Johnny's little dachshund, had wandered home alone, and Johnny was nowhere to be seen. John Sr. knew something was wrong and immediately drove back home and called the police. After, of course, delivering all of Johnny's newspapers first. Some people have found this action strange over the years. Why would Johnny's dad deliver the papers first and not call the police? Maybe you would have acted differently. Unquote. I thought it important to look at this and other points in this case through a 1982 lens before making judgment. But ultimately, I'll let you decide. It was 45 minutes before the police arrived at the Gosh home from the police station, a location which was only 10 blocks away. The first question the police asked the Goshes was whether Johnny had ever run away from home before. Both John Sr. and Noreen were stunned at the question and quickly answered no, Never. The police, it seemed, had already made up their minds that Johnny was simply a runaway, and the case was not of much concern. This seems outlandish by today's standards. But this was a common assumption in the 70s and 80s in regard to missing children. It was always assumed, first and foremost, that children had run away when they were reported missing. Throughout the 1960s and well into the 1970s, the rate of children who ran away from home to set out on their own, so to speak, was far higher than it is today. A CNN report in 2016 stated that between 1967 and 1971, over 500,000 children and teenagers in the United States left home to move into experimental communities. Children who once played on the streets now drifted into areas associated with the counterculture, such as New York's East Village or San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district. Widespread public concern about this phenomenon soon reached Congress, resulting in the Runaway Youth Act of 1974. This had bedded into the psyche of the public, and missing children were given far less importance because of it. Today, less than 100,000 children and teenagers voluntarily leave home. 5 times less than back in the age of freedom throughout the 60s and 70s. The source for this data is the United States government statistics themselves. For balance, whilst Noreen and John Sr. stated that the police were disinterested and said they thought Johnny was simply a runaway, other witnesses from the neighbourhood have stated that the morning of the disappearance, police officers were telling concerned neighbours that it was a suspected kidnapping. Noreen also stated in her book that in the 45 minutes that it took the police to arrive at her home, she had called both of Johnny's siblings and arranged for them to come home immediately. Christy was in college and Joe was at work. And she had called around her neighbours and held brief interviews with them and thus obtained a timeline of events from eyewitnesses as well as a description of the kidnapper. Noreen knew that Johnny was taken and that he did not run away. Once again, and for balance, eyewitness Chris Burge, who saw Johnny minutes before he disappeared, was a neighbour and he knew Johnny and the Gosch family. He, however, disputes Noreen's claims that she had called the neighbours and interviewed them, obtaining a timeline of events and the description of the kidnapper. As we go on, you will see that there are a number of discrepancies between the narrative and timeline that Noreen Gosch claims, and what eyewitnesses and the evidence point to, but we'll talk about that in more detail later. The timeline of events. So what exactly happened that morning in September 1982? Now, researchers, true crime fans, intense Redditors, and independent web sleuths are fanatical about these details. So obviously, we want to get them right. Though there are varying reports and opinions of the exact timeline of events, we are going to reference the events detailed in Noreen Gosch's aforementioned book, but also the police and media reports of the time. We're also going to include some eyewitness details that have been kindly contributed by those in the neighbourhood who were witness to the events at the time. Where contributions are from a specific person, we will credit and reference them if they have agreed for us to do so. We will also respect the anonymity of those who have shared information and detail but wish to remain anonymous. Now that that is clear, let's get into the event timeline. At around 5:45 a.m, a neighbour heard a wagon being pulled through his yard. It was typical for Johnny to cut through the neighbour's yard to get to the street where he picked up his papers from the delivery truck. In total, just an 850 walk from the Gosch home. Johnny had left his house around 5:40 a.m. He had knocked on his brother Joe's bedroom door, but Joe didn't wake that morning. There is a lot of incorrect information out there regarding the morning that Johnny disappeared. Johnny was reported as wearing 2 sets of different clothes, first of all. Denim shorts and a t-shirt, or sweatpants with a Kim's Academy pullover. He was also wearing flip-flops, or sliders as the kids call them today. Thongs in Australia. His brother Joe did not see him that morning. Although Johnny did knock on his bedroom door before he left for his paper route, but Joe was fast asleep at the time and didn't respond. Johnny left his house and walked between the Ranallo and Headlin houses. There was a space in the fence, it's still there today. He then continued up the Ashworth Road pavement. The 2014 documentary titled Who Took Johnny stated that he was first approached by a blue car here. Johnny walked about 2 minutes up the pavement to 42nd and Ashworth Road. Here he encounters Mike Seskis, who is another paperboy slightly older than Johnny, who is assembling his newspapers at the drop-off point. Johnny arrived there to do the same with a red and yellow wagon and his dog, Gretchen. A blue car with Warren County license plates pulls up and starts questioning both boys, allegedly asking them for directions. John Rossi, a neighborhood resident, then pulls up in his car to load his son's papers. Rossi walked over to the car and also answered a question regarding the directions the driver was seeking. The blue car then turned around 180 degrees and headed east on Ashworth Road. John Rossi then left. Johnny walked north on 42nd Street, and as he does so, a man emerges from behind the Davis house and follows Johnny up across the street and north up Ashworth Road. Some witnesses state Johnny and the man were seen talking. Very soon after this, brothers Kevin and Mark Bozen see Johnny sitting on his wagon at Marcourt Lane. They also saw Chris Burge, another paperboy, who was with his father at the corner in their car. The Burges did not see a man talking to Johnny, but they did see Johnny with his wagon and his dog. The Burges continued south to 42nd Street, where their papers were located. By the time they returned to the corner of 42nd and Marcourt, Johnny was gone, although his wagon remained. Normally, Johnny's father woke up on weekend mornings and went with him on his deliveries. Today was the only day that Johnny hadn't woken John up. Noreen said that it was up to Johnny to wake up his father, and today was the first day that he hadn't. She also said that Johnny had been asking for a while to do the paper route on his own, just like the other boys, but his parents had always refused, insisting that John Sr. go with him. A nearby neighbor, John Rossi, remembered seeing Johnny with his wagon and Gretchen, along with two or three other paper boys collecting their newspapers, at a street corner at around 6 a.m. He saw a car pull up next to the boys. The man inside opened the door and put both of his feet out of the car onto the ground. He appeared to be talking, John Rossi said. Johnny then turned to another one of the paper boys and asked them to come over and help this guy. He was asking Johnny for directions to 86th Street. As soon as Johnny called the other paperboys, though, the man spun back into his car, and the man made a quick U-turn and drove off. One witness said that Johnny told him that there was something wrong with that guy, and he was scared a little. The guy seemed kind of weird or off somehow. At the time, no one gave the incident any further thought, however, and Johnny joined a small group of paperboys all rolling and rubber banding the Sunday edition before splitting up on their respective routes. Mike Seskis said that as he picked up his papers, he saw the same car stop and back up to where Johnny in particular was walking. He saw Johnny speak briefly to the driver before it left. Johnny continued on to pick up his papers and load them into his wagon. As Johnny went on his way down the pavement, Mike said that he saw a tall man come out from between two houses and start to follow Johnny on foot. It didn't appear that Johnny noticed this man. The next two witnesses to see Johnny were two other paperboys, as I mentioned previously. They were walking on the pavement across the street and greeted Johnny when they saw him. Johnny spoke back to them for a short while and they all continued on. At a nearby house, PJ Smith heard a car door slam close, which woke him up. He looked outside through his bedroom window and saw a silver and black Ford Fairmont start up from where Johnny was last seen. The car sped off, rolled through a stop sign, making a left turn. Johnny's red wagon was still sitting on the pavement. The other two paper boys, who'd walked past Johnny earlier, walked back and saw the wagon and attended, with newspapers in, but no Johnny. The later consensus amongst witnesses was that the car was a two-door, blue, two-toned Ford Fairmont. As I stated, the first calls from neighbours asking why their newspapers hadn't been delivered began at around 7:30 a.m. This was a full 90 minutes from the last time Johnny was sighted. The investigation. The West Des Moines Police Department did not initially believe that Johnny had been abducted. Straight off the bat, they ruled the case to be nothing more than a child runaway. Hell, if I had a penny for every case I have researched dating back to the 1970s and 80s where a missing person was dismissed as simply a runaway by police, I think I would be a literal millionaire by now. To put it politely, this way of thinking was very common during the 70s and early 80s. It's consistent with many other well-known cases, such as all the children who were abducted by Dean Call and Elmer Wayne Henley, almost a decade before. And of course, let's not forget John Wayne Gacy too. Police would not investigate a missing person until at least 72 hours had passed since they were last seen. This rule applied to both adults and children. Just to clarify, 72 hours is 3 days. Saying this, I will also add for fairness and balance, around 30 police officers did unofficially support with a search for Johnny later that day. I don't want to paint all of the police as inept or uncaring. But the authorities, on the whole, felt that it was highly unlikely that someone would take a 12-year-old boy from a neighbourhood street in the early morning, particularly an area so affluent and safe, such as the location where this happened. It seemed that the police, including their police chief, Orville Cooney, were certain that Johnny had run away, even though there were multiple eyewitnesses to suggest otherwise. They didn't issue the now implemented Amber Alert system, which is the current standard, nor did they start a proper investigation at that point. Police would have a composite sketch of the first man who stopped along Ashworth drawn up, but would never release it to the public or even provide it to the Gosch family. The police later stated the reason for this was that the different witnesses could not agree on exactly what the man looked like, so it seemed pointless. Although it would later emerge that the witnesses did all agree on what the man looked like, so this doesn't make much sense. The police also told the family that they didn't need the FBI's involvement or support because they didn't really have a crime. Their actual words. Noreen responded that she didn't have a son, so how could there be no crime? In the 4 days following their son's disappearance, the Goshes were able to organize a search party themselves, with thanks to friends, neighbors, and local supporters of the family. The Goshes continued to consistently hound the police to take action throughout. They developed a reputation amongst law enforcement in the town as being, quote, obsessed. But neighbors, friends, and supporters of the family said that they had just lost their son. He had been abducted, and the police were not doing anything other than insisting that he had run away. All the family wanted were what the authorities owed them. They just wanted help and support from an official body.
Every time the telephone rings, you know, the heart just pounds out of your chest almost because you're hoping to hear the little voice on the other end saying, Dad. Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.
What was that?
It was a girl from Bend, Oregon that said that she was in a roller skating rink last night and she swore that she saw a boy that looked just like Johnny. And the reason she said that is that she had just stopped at a truck stop and saw one of our flyers. And she said that it looked just like the boy.
We've had calls from every crank in our community, some even long distance, that will call up and say he's dead and laugh at us on the phone. We've had threats against our two older children. These are some of the things that we live with every day. And it's difficult. It's very difficult.
Things are not the same for John and Noreen Gosch.
Things never can be the same. Their son is missing. 12-year-old Johnny Gosch vanished on a warm Sunday morning last September while delivering newspapers in this neighborhood in West Des Moines, Iowa. No one saw a kidnapping. No one heard a child scream. Suddenly, two blocks from his home, Johnny was simply gone.
I would like to speak directly to the people who are holding our son. Contact us, please. We'll meet your demands. This is a plea for you to release our son.
From the beginning, the Goshes said Johnny was abducted. While search parties combed through fields and woods near Johnny's home, the West Des Moines Police Department maintained the child was a runaway.
Is this still being treated as a missing persons case at this point?
Yes, it is.
You don't think it's a kidnapping, though, do you?
I'm not ruling out anything, but I have nothing to indicate that it was a kidnapping.
Hundreds of leads and thousands of reported sightings were checked out. Still, with all of this effort, the Goshes say it wasn't enough.
The problem is that they thought from the beginning that Johnny was a runaway. They did not want to act like the child had been abducted. And so they just sat back, put their feet up on their desk, shut off their mouth, and really did not get with the program like they should have.
The police department, not only in this town, but in most towns, will tell you that you don't have a crime until you have evidence of a crime.
Literally, they're still telling us that they have no crime. Well, we no longer have a son, do we?
Rapport between the Goshes and the police department hit rock bottom when Police Chief Orville Cooney, now on sick leave, told the Des Moines Register, "I don't give a damn what Noreen Gosch has to say. I'm kind of sick of her."
Johnny Gosch was 11 years old when he disappeared. His parents had an artist draw this picture of what he might look like now. He was 5'7" then. He may be 6'1" now. Noreen Gosch believes Johnny tried to call her one night last February. In three calls, each lasting less than a minute, she said he begged for help.
These were news reports and interviews from the time. You'll notice that there is some incorrect information that has since been updated. At one point, Police Chief Cooney said, in front of the gathered search group, that there was no crime here, that Johnny was simply a runaway and would come home when he was hungry. This attitude alone jeopardized the finding of Johnny, with the police themselves stating that in an abduction case, the first 48 hours are the most important with tracking down the missing person, even though they would take no action until 72 hours had passed. Somewhat contradictory. The searchers were confused as to why the parents were saying that Johnny was abducted, but police were denying it. In desperation, the Goshes reached out to a psychic medium who told them that their son was dead and that his body would be found within 2 miles of their home near a creek. The search group thus scoured the surrounding areas and creeks as a result, but found nothing. Police Chief Cooney continued to deny that there was any crime that had been committed despite Noreen's persistence and the information from the witnesses. In a live news conference interview, Chief Cooney stated, quote, "I don't give a damn what Noreen Gosch has to say." Despite the inaction of the Des Moines police, Johnny was still missing and they were no closer to finding him. A composite sketch of the man that had been seen driving the Ford Fairmont was released to the public by the Gosch family. They had the composite created independently from several eyewitness descriptions. Along with the sketch, a description of the man was released that read that he was 5'9", 175 pounds, had dark eyes and black eyebrows. He was older, early to mid-40s, black hair, combed back, full in back, black moustache, or unshaven appearance, Latin or Hispanic in appearance. This man may be driving a two-tone blue car, real dark top and light blue bottom, mid-size, 79 to 81 model, clean inside and outside, no vinyl top plush interior, with a Warren County, Iowa plate. Time passes. Time continued to pass, but with little to no new developments in Johnny's case. Noreen and John Sr., however, continued to search and continued the fight to keep their son's name in the spotlight and in the media. But within a few months of Johnny's disappearance, complaints and grievances began to emerge against Police Chief Cooney and his police department.
The Des Moines Tribune reports 18 officers making allegations against Chief Cooney, including doing police work after drinking, fixing the tickets of friends and relatives, being racially prejudiced, and interfering with a department investigation against one of his sons. Both Cooney and Mayor George Mills say the actions of this many officers in a 37-person department cannot be ignored.
A city investigation would clear Chief Cooney of most of the allegations, although serious administrative problems were cited. 6 months later, Cooney would resign from his post in shame. A month before the abduction, John Sr. stated that a woman sitting in a car with California license plates seemed to be taking photos of Johnny. Further, the night before Johnny's abduction, when the family were attending a high school football game, a police officer would be seen speaking to Johnny underneath the bleachers. Chief Cooney refused to provide records of police officers working that game. In later years, the officer was identified and cleared of all suspicion, however. Despite no movement in her son's case, Noreen never backed down in the crusade to find Johnny. She regularly booked television and newspaper interviews. She had flyers, badges, and signs printed, and was not quiet about her search for her son. Even to this very day, Noreen Gosh remains a staunch campaigner for missing children, more than 40 years after her son went missing. Over the years, the Goshes would receive hundreds of phone calls and letters from families across the country who also had missing children. These families expressed their sympathy for what the Goshes were going through, as well as their frustration with the inaction of law enforcement. The letters gave Noreen and John Sr. strength and the drive to continue in their search. The Goshes would soon be contacted by a man named Ken Wooden. Kenneth Wooden was originally an investigative journalist and producer for US Network Television. He was very well respected for his work on ABC News, 2020, CBS 60 Minutes, and NBC News International. During his career, Wooden had focused much of his research and investigations primarily into issues and crimes focusing on children, their exploitation and abduction. He was a pioneer in this field at a time when there was a much more rosy image of the country by the general public. Later on in his career, he garnered the acclaim of being known as a child safety expert, and he was heralded as a champion for children. Wooden interviewed many convicted sex offenders and abductors over the years. During hundreds of such interviews, Ken uncovered the diverse and imaginative strategies used by sexual predators to entrap their victims. These methods, coupled with Ken's proven prevention techniques, gave Wooden an awareness and special expertise in the area of child abduction. In the early 1980s, the term pedophile was not in the common vernacular. In fact, Noreen had never heard the word before. Most people hadn't. As shocking and upsetting as it was for Johnny's parents to hear, Wooden told the Goshes that Johnny was likely in the hands of a pedophile. Cheers, Ken. Further abductions. So, and just to pause where we are with Johnny for a moment, as this now starts to get much bigger. By June 1984, along with John Walsh, the father of missing Florida child Adam Walsh, Noreen and John Gosh became part of a group of parents who would begin the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, a non-profit organization that still operates to this day. The Goshes would also lobby for the quote, Johnny Gosh Bill in Iowa, which would require immediate police response when a child went missing. It was signed into Iowa law on July 1, 1984, 2 weeks after President Reagan held the official opening ceremony for the National Center on the White House lawn. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be long before Iowa's new law would be put into action. On August the 12th, 1984, around 2 years after Johnny's disappearance, 13-year-old Eugene Martin also disappeared while delivering newspapers early one morning. Just 43 days after the Johnny Gosch bill was passed in Iowa, Eugene Martin had left his home on Frazier Avenue at 5 a.m. It was the morning of Sunday, August 12, 1984, on the south side of Des Moines. Much like, as in West Des Moines, the south side was, and still is, on the outskirts of town. It's flanked on one side by the International Airport, and on the other by numerous parks and lakes. Historically, the south side has been an industrial operation area, and hosts affordable housing, which draws in a culturally diverse group of working class families. Once again, eyewitnesses reported seeing young Eugene talk to a clean-cut Caucasian male in his mid-30s, sometime between 5 a.m. and 6:05 a.m. Between 6:10 and 6:15 a.m., Eugene's newspaper bag was found abandoned on the ground with his newspapers still inside. Eugene was living with his father and stepmother, along with their five children, and typically his older brother accompanied him on his paper route. But he had spent the night prior at a friend's house. Gene, as he was called, enjoyed fishing, playing football, roller skating, and cartoons. He loved Scooby-Doo. The Iowa Fair was approaching, so Eugene was saving his money from the paper route for said carnival. His 14th birthday was coming up in a week, too. About 15 minutes after leaving home, Eugene arrived on the corner of 14th Street and Highview. It was a 3/4 mile walk from his house. Here, he would collect the Des Moines Register papers and begin to roll them. It was the same newspaper that Johnny Gosch delivered. Remember this. 45 minutes later, around 6 a.m., the newspaper began to receive calls that newspaper along Eugene's route weren't being delivered. The route manager immediately drove over to the pickup spot and would find Eugene's delivery bag abandoned on the ground, full with 10 rolled Sunday editions inside. The route manager assumed that Eugene had simply left, so the manager delivered the newspapers himself before heading to the Martins' home to ask what had happened. It was only then that everyone realized another paper boy had gone missing in Des Moines. At least due to the new protocol, police did immediately launch into action, issuing an all-police bulletin and alerting the FBI. With the lieutenant telling his force, quote, "I do not want another botched West Des Moines missing kid deal." 16 FBI agents would also join in the search, stating that there might be a connection to Johnny Gosch. Although, even though the lieutenant had made these comments, and the FBI's reason for interest, the Des Moines police officially stated that they did not believe the disappearance of Eugene Martin and Johnny Gosch were related. The Des Moines Register, which employed about 2,000 paperboys and girls at the time, had previously issued a reward for $5,000 for information leading to the safe return of Johnny Gosch. But that now increased to $25,000 for any information about the two missing boys. This equates to around $85,000 today. Police tracked down the owner of a green car seen in the area the morning of Eugene's disappearance, which witnesses said appeared to be following two women. But the driver was cleared after it was discovered that he had simply been dropping his wife off to work. Another three people had stated that they spotted Eugene speaking to a clean-cut 30-something-year-old man while folding his papers. And it appeared to be a friendly conversation, as if they were father and son. A police sketch was released of that man. But these two potential early leads aside, police failed to identify any further promising information and stated that they found no evidence or suspects in conjunction with the case. 4 days after Eugene went missing, President Ronald Reagan personally phoned the Martins and asked if there was anything he could do to help. The Des Moines Register had suggested to the Martins that missing persons flyers be put up in post offices around the country. The Martins relayed this suggestion to the president, which he immediately agreed to. Reagan would walk back on this promise a week later, however, when federal officials told him it probably wouldn't be effective, so Reagan didn't follow through on the promise. 5 days after his abduction, on what would have been Eugene's 14th birthday, the combined reward fund had climbed to $64,000, and by the end of the month, it would top $110,000. The community and the Gosch family would pledge their support. Iowa's then governor, Terry Branstad, also met with the Martin family and told the press that he held a personal interest in the case. Within weeks of the abduction, the local Hy-Vee supermarket began printing Johnny and Eugene's faces on their plastic bags with reward information. It was a concept that struck a chord with an employee at the local Anderson Erickson Dairy Company too. He suggested to his company managers that they should put the missing boys' faces on the side of the company's milk cartons. The managers liked the idea and went through with it. The concept soon became a nationwide program in the following January. Eugene has never been seen since, and his disappearance remains unsolved.
Another Des Moines newsboy disappeared while delivering Sunday newspapers. Because of a new state law the Gosches helped push through, the police started looking for Gene Martin right away. He's still missing, too.
What happened to 13-year-old Eugene Martin?
I want to believe that he's still alive. And whoever's got him, all they have to do is let us know where he's at, and we'll go get him and bring him home. But if he is dead, I still want to know so we can bring him home and give him a decent burial.
Mr. Martin, did your son know about the Johnny Gosch case?
Yes, he's heard of it, and he's been aware of the story of Johnny Gosch and all.
Is it possible that the same person kidnapped both boys, or is that just a coincidence?
It's possible. At this point, they have not determined whether there is a link between the two cases yet, but there's a great many facts that are very striking.
Are you hopeful that the trail for Eugene Martin might lead to Johnny, too?
Yes, we are.
Steve Kramus, Metro Circulation Manager, ordered the department's 49 supervisors to drive through their districts and oversee morning deliveries.
Then, on March 29th, 1986, 13-year-old Mark James Allen also disappeared, yet again in Des Moines, Iowa. Mark had told his mother that he was walking to a friend's house, which was nearby. He asked his mother to save him some pizza that she was preparing, as he'd be hungry when he got home. But Mark never returned home. Police yet again assumed that he was a runaway and would continue to deny any connection between Johnny, Eugene, and Mark's disappearances, even though the modus operandi of all three cases were exactly identical, the three boys fit the same descriptions, and the locations of all three disappearances were within 5 miles of one another. In 1981, the population of Des Moines was roughly 270,000. This is roughly half the size of the city that I currently live in. Google the population of the area where you live. These children of the same age, kidnapped in the same area, over a very short period of time, in a population of that size. You tell me if you think it sounds suspicious, if you think it's highly likely that they were linked. Also, why would the police, who are experts in these matters, be so firm that they were not connected? Something doesn't seem to add up here. Noreen Gosch publicly said at the time that she felt the three cases were indeed connected, and that the boys were possibly the victims of a human trafficking ring. Mark Allen's case is still unsolved to this day. Strange twists. In July 1985, the Gosches received an anonymous phone call at around 9 p.m. one evening. The caller told John Sr. that he had received a $1 bill in change from a grocery store in Sioux Falls, Iowa, and that there was a handwritten message written on it. The lady on the telephone read the message to John Sr. It said, quote, "I am alive. signed Johnny Gosch. John Sr. arranged for the lady to send the dollar bill to him. Noreen and John were confident that this was unmistakably their son's handwriting. But to be sure, they arranged for handwriting experts to analyze the message. After three separate handwriting analysts examined the signature, they all vehemently believed the handwriting to be authentic. The experts confirmed it was Johnny's handwriting with more than a 90% certainty. This gave Noreen and John Sr. renewed hope that they would find their son alive, prompting Johnny's parents to offer $400,000 for his safe return in a public statement. But then another bill turned up, and another, and then another, until the FBI announced that at least the majority of the bills thus far, seven in total, were actually cruel hoaxes. But not surprisingly, the police also didn't think that the note meant much, because, well, that train is never late. Nothing further came from the dollar bill. Next, the Goshes would receive a letter that said Johnny had been kidnapped by a motorcycle gang who were operating a child slavery ring. A clandestine meeting was held with the letter writer in Kansas City, a man named Robert Herman Mayer. He said that he was a former bike gang member and would try to get Johnny back from a Mexican drug lord who had purchased Johnny for a simple $10,000 fee. The Goshes paid this money only for Maya to flee and hide out at a dude ranch in Tennessee, arranging for a friend to write to the family saying that he had died during his rescue attempt of Johnny. Robert Maya was soon arrested for this scam and tried yet again to make a deal to provide information before eventually admitting his lies and receiving a 3-year prison sentence for wire fraud. The following year, yet another man from Syracuse, New York, tried the same stunt. This time he asked for just $2,500, and when he met with undercover FBI agents posing as the Gosch family, he too was arrested. Up until this point in the story, what I have described has been a simple missing persons case. Well, as simple as the case is, albeit with some strange and frustrating twists thrown in, well, things will soon develop into another beast altogether. And things will get really crazy. Tune in on Tuesday for part 2 of What Happened to Johnny, where we will reveal possible links to a huge national conspiracy and a child abduction ring that will shock the country. Finally, if you haven't already, sign up to our Patreon for more episodes, research material, and articles. It's just $2, so a hell of a bargain for the amount of extra content that you get. Head over to patreon.com/deadsouls. A huge thank you to everyone who has already joined. We truly value your support. Good night, everyone.